desert oasis where stories ignite. Skip's little bar, a beacon of light. From the Coachella Valley stars to cool everyday movers and shakers on the show. Join Patrick and Randy, let the stories flow. At Big Conversations, Little Bar, the magic spreads near and far. Presented on Mutual by the McCallum Theater. Candid tales are shared. Nothing could make this sweeter.
Welcome to the center of the Coachella Valley universe. You've made it to Skip Page's Little Bar with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence. Get ready for another fun and story-filled episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar, presented by the McCallum Theater. Order tickets now by visiting McCallumTheater.org or call the box office at 760-340-2787. Now, in their eighth season, here are your hosts, Patrick and Randy.
Thank you, Alfonso. We are delighted to be back here in the corner booth at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California. I love that intro. David Church is with us, author. David Church, a local author. And I will say, you know, often when I say people were guests on Eye on the Desert, I had the chance to meet them. I did not. I was off that day, Spencer interview, so I missed that. So I'm glad to have this opportunity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Really glad to have you here.
All right, you have a copy of the book, so hand it over to me if you would.
Sure.
Because I want to give you the shout-out that you deserve. Thomas Edison and the Magi Solution is the name of the book. This is the third in the series, is that correct?
Third and final, yeah.
Third of this is it?
This is it.
Okay, well, before we jump into the series, what's next then? When you wrap something up, I know you have something else up
your sleeve. I am actually working on a play right now, and there is a role.
Well, this worked out great.
He's big into movies now. I'm not sure he's really leaning into his theater days.
As you can tell, I don't really know what I'm in.
When the play becomes a movie. No, that's my next project. I don't know if there'll be any more of these Edison books. They have been a pleasure to work on, but they require an enormous amount of research to make sure that even though they're adventures with a fantastic element, that the groundwork is all there.
So the premise, and you're working with the real life facts of Thomas Edison,
yes.
but you were putting him into a more fantasy setting. It's kind of changing Correct. History a bit, right?
Correct. It's historical fiction with a fantastic element to it.
Your interest in Edison came from a very interesting place because it's something I had read about at some time in the past, where he was trying to figure out, much like we knew about our intellect and our physical nature, the spiritual nature
yes.
of the bodies. And he was trying to actually quantify that.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about how you came across that?
Yeah, and I'll kind of give you the origin story on this. I was at home one day messing around, doing stuff, multitasking, and the History Channel was on in the background. And I heard the narrator of a documentary piece intone that Thomas Edison invented the electric light and the phonograph and et cetera, et cetera. And he even tried to invent a machine that would communicate with the dead. And I thought, I've never heard this before.
Because he seems like such a practical man. That seems like an impractical choice.
Yes. And so I thought, okay, I called the Edison Laboratory. There are two. There's one in West Orange, New Jersey, and there's also one in Fort Myers, which is where he had his winter home. And I contacted them, and I talked to the docent, and I said, I just heard this. Is this true? And she said, yes, it is true. In point of fact, there's quite a bit of material on this. So I said, well, what books would you recommend? Or what articles? And so she gave me a list. I went through it, and I thought, this is something. I don't know what this is, but this is really intriguing. And so I began to look for how I could portray this. And if I did, what year and what would be the circumstances? And the year that I hit on was 1918, because he was actively promoting this event, invention at the time. He would give press conferences and talk about anything, because he was a bit of a Barnum at heart. And I learned that in February of 1918, the United States was formally entering World War I. And at the same time, in that month, Edison disappeared for literally a month, and no one knew where he was. And I thought, well, if he invented a machine that could communicate with the dead, and if it's not just a spirit box, but if it's a traveling machine, maybe he went to purgatory. And indeed, the book is called Thomas Edison and the Purgatory Equation.
Wow.
And that's
the setup. Crazy.
It's interesting just to wrap my mind around the concept of that. And I mean, you found that inspiration just in this device that, and it didn't really work, one would assume.
Do we
know?
What I went with it in terms of the traveling machine, that's all me. No,
that's you.
The spirit box is Edison. And it's interesting. No one knows if it worked or not, but this is something he continued to promote for years, and then suddenly he never discussed it again.
Wow.
So we really don't know the specifics on that. In truth, he would promote many inventions that he conceptualized but never came to fruition, because that's the kind of mind he had.
Sales guy at heart.
He was.
But this was unique. And he believed that you could tap into other dimensions or into the afterlife through bending sound waves. So in my particular piece, the machine that you have is this huge sort of time machine type of machine that is studded with tuning forks. And Edison actually had, a formula for this. It was called the 3S formula: speed, revolving, sound, the tuning forks that are honed to a particular pitch, and then a shock of electricity that sends you into the afterlife.
Wow. And this is all you.
This is me. But he did, in point of fact, invent a spirit box. And he believed by manipulating sound, he could tap into the other world.
All right, when you were doing your research for this,
yes,
you must have learned a great deal about the spirit box. What was the actual device like?
It literally was a black box. And it would be similar to the phonograph in that he, or a radio. You know the old line in Raiders of the Lost Ark where they say the Ark is a radio to God? Mm. There is that quality. We don't know enough about it to know if he was successful at this. However, I did learn one interesting thing. At the time, there was a very famous Russian psychic named Madame Blavatsky, spiritualist. And she plays a role in the beginning of book one. And once I had finished that, I discovered that Edison had been one of her champions and was one of the first people to belong to her. I think it was the Theosophy Society. So he's a complex individual.
What was it? Because, I mean, that's a couple of different sides of your brain.
it is.
At least four.
Four sides of it. Do you have any idea in the work that you did on researching him, where this kind of came from? Was he a spiritual or occultist kind of person as a younger man?
There is a personal jumping off point for him. When he was engrossed in inventing the electric light, he used everything he could, every kind of filament he could, as the conduit. And I could...
A thousand of them.
There's a thousand of them, which I won't list. But they all failed.
We've got time.
But they all failed. They would not hold the charge. They might light, but they wouldn't hold the charge. And concurrently, his own children really didn't have a love for what he did or a capacity for it. But he had a nephew named Charlie. And Charlie was spiritually his true son. And Charlie had gone to Europe at Edison's request to open up his business there, and was very successful at it. But Charlie fell in love, and it turned out that the person he fell in love with was a man. This is true. And Edison begged him to break this relationship, that it would serve no good purpose whatsoever. But Charlie was rather headstrong. He proceeded with the relationship. It was very fulfilling for him until in the fall of, I forget which year, he became very ill. And Edison remembers that the trauma he was having in trying to invent the electric light and perfect it was concurrent with the trauma of knowing that Charlie was deathly ill in Europe, and there was nothing he really could do. I mean, he obviously summoned the best doctors, did what he could in that respect, but it was hopeless, and Charlie died. And Edison remembers that on that particular evening, he went into a very troubled sleep, and Charlie came to him in a dream. He did not speak. He simply put his hands up in the form of a horseshoe. And Edison woke up from his dream and realized it's not the type of filament, it is the shape of the filament. And he rushed to the laboratory, tried it out, got his assistants out of bed, tried it out, and the charge held.
Wow.
Now, in truth, other people remember this as happening on two separate occasions, but within the same general area. But even into his later age, Edison believed it happened within a 24-hour period. So there you go.
You did an amazing amount of research. You must know Edison really extremely well.
Well, I'll tell you, I'm not a biographer. I'm not someone like Edmund Morris, who wrote a great biography of Edison. Just superb. But I am a little bit of a poacher. And if I see something, if I do say so myself, and if I see something that in history that I think, oh, wow, I never knew that, that could be something. Then I make a note of it, and I'm able to revisit it. And maybe there's a place for it in the story, and maybe there's not. But boy, I'll tell you, I learned an awful lot.
Are there other projects where you have followed this same kind of path?
A long time ago, I worked on a screenplay that was about a black wagon train. And this is based on fact that never came to fruition. But there was a movement, I believe after the Civil War, where there was a concerted effort politically to take black Americans and send them back to Africa. But they didn't want to do it. It was too expensive. And so there were certain elements within the government who were not quite as charitable, who thought maybe we can put them out on reservations like we're doing with the Indians, and it appears we're doing them a service, and we just starve them out. And so that never went anywhere. But I thought, what if there was a test case? And what if the man they hire is a washed-up old cattleman like a John Wayne type or someone like that who is paid to lead them out and really hates the assignment, only wants the money, but realizes that these people have what it takes to be citizens, not the people who are trying to stop them.
Yeah.
So... yeah, so in something like that, I had to make sure that I was at least in the, you know, in the Western ballpark, and that required a lot of research. It's a daunting thing to do, but it's really rewarding.
Well, I want to find out more about how you got here with these books and the one you just discussed. Born in Indiana?
Yep, born in Indiana.
How long were you there?
I was there until I was 18, and then I happily got out. I went to college in Boston, which I loved. It's a great place to go to school. I have still many good friends from that period of time. Then when I left, it was sort of like, do I go to New York? Do I, you know, push into playwriting full time, or do I come to the West Coast? And I came to the West Coast.
And what did you start doing?
I started writing screenplays. And I had some success with it in a mild way. It's, as you know, it's a completely arbitrary business.
Yeah.
But I'm in the guilds, you know, and I sold some stuff and made some money at it. And, you know, things get developed and then they don't happen. But nonetheless, I was able to sort of juxtapose my time between working in a corporate situation where I did creative services and stuff like that, or working for... you know, CBS, NBC. I wrote a screenplay called Psychic Housewife for United Artists. Mm. Kept busy with that. But I reached a point where I needed to really make some money. You know, you go through periods where you're making money and then you're not. And I thought, it's time to make some money again.
I've never been through a period where you're making a lot of money. I missed that part.
I had heard tell of it. But
I'm in the then you're not phase. Yeah. I have been for the last 50 plus years, but that's okay.
Okay. Well, nonetheless, I had thought about this for a while. And finally, I thought, well, maybe this, I actually met with an agent and I said, here's this pitch. And he said, look, this is going to be very expensive. It's got a ton of special effects. It's a period piece. Why don't you write it as a book? Now, he wasn't particularly saying this out of kindness. It's that he knew he couldn't sell an expensive period piece. Right. However, I thought about it and I thought, yeah, maybe. I've never written a novel, but I thought, well, maybe this is a good challenge. And so I wrote it, and I overwrote it tremendously. It was way longer than it should have been. Oh, my God. And I put it down for a year, and then I went back to it and thought, well, I've got to cut like 50 pages. And then I put it down for another year, and I went back, and I thought, yep, I got to cut 50 more. But nonetheless, I finally got it where I wanted it. And when I did, I thought it was a very – I was satisfied with the ending. And I thought, I think there's more to this. So I thought about it for a while, and I thought, well, if you do it, what's the timeline? How's this going to kick in? And I figured it out. So
it just came to you?
No, it came to me after 5 months.
Overnight
it was
sensation.
It was a long coming to period.
So where did this all come from? I read something where you said your parents were somewhat puzzled with your career choice.
Always.
Yeah. what did they do? And did you come from a big family?
No, I'll tell you what I have. My parents were great. My dad was a lawyer. My mom was a housewife. My brother is still back in Indiana, has a company. He's done very well for himself. I'm sort of the strange bohemian of the family. But I will tell you, and I mentioned this at the end of the third book, I really credit my father with this, because one day when I was like 5 years old, and I was kind of a nervous little boy in a town that I didn't really feel I belonged in a small Indiana town, out of the blue, he decided, I'm going to take him to the movies. And we went to see The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Oh.
I
remember that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And it's got, my God, Bernard Herrmann's music and Harryhausen's
the stop motion anime.
All that stuff. And, you know, and it also had a Sinbad who was particularly athletic, more Malibu than Baghdad, but that's okay. And it just opened my world. And I realized that my hometown would always be my hometown, but I was going to go and travel. And that really helped me get through those first 18 years of my life. So this is kind of my tribute to that kind of film, which is a fantastic adventure, but I've tried to ground it in history as much as possible since I'm dealing with real people.
In the most recent edition, you've got Noel Coward. As a main character, but and the reincarnated spirit of Thomas Edison, is that accurate?
Yes,
and they're all on a mission to stop Hitler.
Yes,
okay,
you got it.
Well, in a fact, I read.
I do have it because I'm reading it right off the back of the book.
It says one of the reviews: if you ever wondered what would happen if Indiana Jones met Thomas Edison, crossed paths with Groucho Marx, and all three went on a mission to save the world from Hitler. That describes the book?
It describes book two, because Groucho's in book two. I will tell you what I wanted to do.
What was book two?
It's right there.
Oh.
Actually, that's book one. Book two is right there.
Okay, here we go. So we've got the purgatory equation is book one.
Book one.
The Lazarus vessel is book two.
Right.
And Groucho Marx is right there.
Yep.
On the cover.
And there he is.
And then the Magi solution. Book three.
And I will tell you what I wanted to do with all, once I realized I was doing the three books. In the first book, Jack Warner used to say he had his formula for success, which was brawn, brains, beauty, and best friend. And in that first book, I've got Brawn, who is Edison's assistant, kind of a jack of all trades named John Dawkins. Brains is Edison. Beauty is the woman who turns out to be John's girlfriend, who is named Ebley Auburn, who's a Ziegfeld Follies showgirl. And then the best friend is a 19-year-old struggling composer who's playing as a rehearsal pianist, and his name is George Gershwin. Because I thought, well, if I'm going to have a best friend, why don't I pick people that I admire and would love to spend time with? And so in the second book, I thought, okay, who's going to be the best friend? And it said in 1933, and I thought, well, that's the screwball comedy era. So why not spend some time with Groucho?
So now you had to do more research into these. You could have made up a fictional best friend.
If only I'd known.
But once you put a real person into that role,
yes,
you have to spend a lot of time fleshing that out with real facts.
Yes, but what's interesting is, and this is a little spooky, it, the reality of where they were in their lives at that point dovetails with what's going on. It was really stark. Sometimes you just go, this can't be, and it is. and then in the third book, it was Noel Coward, because you may know that Coward obviously was sort of the playboy of the West End in London and what have you, and a master of, you know, acting and singing and writing and composing. But what a lot of people don't know is he was also an undercover spy for the British government.
Did not know that.
No.
So that's real.
Yes, that is real.
Because, I mean, that's what you say right here.
Yep.
But that was actually a fact.
It is a fact.
Didn't know that.
He says that in World War I, he was the most hapless recruit in the history of the British Army. And he was just terrible, and it didn't work out. So when World War II came along, he was put into a propaganda role in Paris. And that didn't work out either, because the people that he was working with, the government guys, just didn't like him, and they didn't agree with him. So he was very bereft because he wanted to do something. At one point he says in the book and in life, I wanted to prove my own integrity to myself. And one of his best friends was Ian Fleming, the author of James Bond books.
Yep.
And he said, I think I know what you can do to help us. Why don't you be an Uber version of who you are? A frivolous fop who no one thinks has an idea in his head, and listen and take notes. And that's what he did.
Wow. Fascinating stuff. That's so cool.
I'm just sitting here with my mouth hanging open.
I just love how you populate these stories with you pick and choose from history and plug it all together.
I've never felt less imaginative than I do right now.
Well, right now is a good opportunity for us to just take a quick break and talk to some more imaginative people over at the McCallum Theater, our presenting sponsor. Remember that you can get tickets right now at McCallumTheater.org. A quick word from our sponsors.
The McCallum Theater's 2025-26 season is on sale now, featuring audience favorites and expanded programming with more than 20 brand new shows, including 7 Broadway shows with 4 desert premieres. Highlights include a robust offering of holiday events and a great lineup of classical, dance, comedy, cabaret, and more. The McCallum entertains, educates, and enriches the Coachella Valley through world-class performances at the desert's premier performing arts center. We kick off the season on September 10th with the Righteous Brothers. John Lovitz brings his comedy to the McCallum on September 13th, Mexican regional vocalist Camila Fernandez is in concert on September 14th, and on September 21st, comedian Monique Marvez brings her smart, sexy, and self-aware humor to the stage. Tickets are on sale now at McCallumTheater.org or by calling the box office at 760-340-2787. Your entertainment, your theater, the McCallum Theater.
All right, folks, get your tickets, McCallumTheater.org. We are here with David Church, local author. He's got 3 terrific books, all about Thomas Edison, who plays the major role in each of the books. But his best friends end up being some very interesting people.
Indeed.
We've just been discussing. Now, you mentioned that started out as a screenplay.
Yes.
And someone said, yeah, maybe better as a book. But do you have the aspiration to turn these into a film?
These read very cinematically. So, I mean, to me, it's a natural. To someone else, who knows? But I'm hoping that there will be ancillary benefits down the line. How about that? Or ancillary markets down the line.
Has anybody looked at it from that?
You know, not really. Not yet. And I kind of wanted to get all three books done before I started pushing it too hard. And now it's sort of time to push it hard. But I wanted to feel secure with what I had and to know that it really tracked and led to a satisfying resolution. And it does.
Well, I mean, it apparently in the second two books, you've got the Nazis as the villain.
Yes.
That's always a good call.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always a good call.
I haven't read many books where they weren't.
Well, you don't have to look too far to find a villain. And in the third book, I'll tell you, I really thought when I started this, I thought, David, you're biting off way more than you can chew because I've got Satan and Hitler.
Yes.
What a combo.
It's like an episode of
South
Park.
They seem like they would have been best friends.
Well, you would think so. But it's a complicated relationship. You'll see as it goes on. And I had to find a way to take the curse off of both of them. So, because I thought, we've seen Satan a zillion times. We've seen Hitler a zillion times. And there is a great foreign film, I think a German film, called Downfall, that is about the final days in the bunker with Hitler. And it is just brilliant. And I thought, I have to find a way to take something that is already brilliant and just give it a little extra side view. And so what happens is our heroes are in Germany. Hitler sends them on a suicide mission. And the one person who is left behind with him in the bunker is John Dawkins' wife, Sophie, who used to be a reporter for the New York Herald Tribune. And she is called upon to use all her reporter's savvy and her feminine charms to survive and to see her relationship in the bunker through to its conclusion. So there's that. So you have dual stories. And I've tried to show that, look, Hitler's a monster. But even monsters started out as children. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you read about him, he had a horrible father who was incredibly abusive, a mother who tried to protect him and died when he was very young. So out of such things comes this. In terms of Satan, I thought, well, how am I going to do this? Is it going to be a scaly-tailed guy or what? And I thought, you know, if I was Satan, I'd want to play different parts. I'd want to wear different costumes. I'd be bored after all these millennia. So basically, I thought, well, who would be a really fun, you know, actor or actress for Satan to inhabit? And I thought of Judi Dench. And so basically, it's Judi Dench.
That's so awesome.
Wow.
You know, as Satan, because she's charming and delightful, and she can turn cold as ice in a
very
moment's
quickly.
Notice.
Yeah.
Wow. So when you're writing, is that part of kind of your mental process is thinking not just about the character, but like picking a Judi Dench and writing to that?
That came pretty early, yeah.
Okay.
And that you hear that voice.
Who would you have play Edison?
You know, I think there are a couple of people who could do it. I would say I initially thought Nathan Lane would be marvelous because he has that sense of bombast, that sort of Professor Marvel quality. And then I thought maybe Paul Giamatti.
Oh, that's a good call.
Okay. Or if you really want to go big budget, you get Tom Hanks in because Tom Hanks does everything beautifully.
Yeah, it's true.
You know, he's not a perfect match, but my God, he could act the hell out of it. So that's kind of, you know, you have those things in your mind's eye. I will tell you the one thing, it's not so much the actors per se. It's that, I say this to anyone who wants to write an adventure screenplay or a novel, get the collected works of John Williams and plug them in, because those scores are beautifully calibrated to action.
Oh, they're so swashbuckling.
Oh, it's just my God.
It's the right era. I mean, like, you're pulling... Yeah, I can hear a Williams score to the stories you're telling.
Yeah, exactly.
What did you read growing up? You know, I think I read most everything that kids normally read. I mean, you know, nothing extraordinary.
Any favorite authors?
Boy,
I didn't read very much fiction. I read a lot of biography, some history.
Who were some of your favorite biographies that you read, the ones that resonated with you?
I will tell you that, I'll tell you the writer, I was thinking about him the other day, Gore Vidal. I thought he was a
phenomenal
great,
writer.
Great historian, And his, and more than that, his essays were superb. They're so cogent, and they really apply to a lot of what's going on today.
Yeah.
So that's probably one of my favorite writers. And theatrically, I love Sondheim. I think he's just marvelous. And I'm very fortunate. I've been able to meet some of those people through the years. And not that we're buds or we were even good acquaintances, but it's wonderful to be in the presence of someone who you admire that much.
Oh, 100%. I agree with that. Yeah.
I'm here every week with Patrick. I get to see him.
See, there you
just,
go.
Just like this.
You are an inspiration to
you
me.
Are spoiled.
I want to be a retired banker one day. I just want to sit back and light cigars with $100 bills. And
just as I am right
that's
now.
That's what you do.
Emerson College is where you went to college?
Yes.
What degree did you graduate with?
You know, it's kind of an odd degree. It was, a BS in theater arts or something like
Emerson's
that.
Emerson's a very, it's a good broadcasting school. I worked with a couple of great people who came out of that broadcasting
it
school.
It is. Yeah, I worked on WERS. I worked on the radio a little bit. I did reviews for the student paper, that kind of thing. It was a wonderful school because it's basically just an old bunch of buildings in Back Bay. And I'll tell you, if you want to try something, they let you try it and magic happens. It's great.
That, yeah, it really feeds the creativity.
It does.
Now, do you still do corporate work? You said you kind of, you know.
No, I kind of phased out of that a couple of years ago. I was very busy with these books and I was, you know, secure enough that I felt I could move forward and no issues and enjoyed my time while I did it and learned a lot about corporate speak and don't want to speak it anymore.
Yeah, yeah. It's not a lot
you
of fun.
You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
What brought you to the desert?
I had lived in L.A. for many years. After college, I came out here. And I love L.A., but I just, this was during COVID, and I thought, you know, I think maybe it's time for a change. And I had vacationed out here a lot through the years. This is a great weekend getaway. And I had some friends who lived out here. In point of fact, more friends were moving out here. Yeah. And I thought, this might be the time. And so I did it. And I don't regret it for a moment. It's been marvelous. I think it's a great way to live. I think that it's, someone had asked me what Palm Springs is like, and I said, it's sort of a progressive small town with great restaurants.
Yeah.
And now, more so than I think ever before, it has wonderful theater opportunities, wonderful artistic opportunities. I mean, I saw Leroy Reams at the old, Broadway chorus boy, who's like, I say old, because now he's like 80 something, but my God, he's got it. He still has got it. And he was performing at the Coachella Valley Rep in his one-man show. I would, it's all out there if you want it.
It's funny that population exists here.
Yes,
and a lot of them don't even know. All of a sudden, they'll see somebody, they'll go, oh, you live here too.
Yeah.
But we've talked to enough people on this podcast that have come into town thinking that they might be the only entertainer living in the high desert or something like that, and then they just find out they're a part of a community.
Yes.
Have you discovered that too?
I think there's more of them now. I remember in the past when I've come out here, I remember going to Jensen's one day on a really hot day, seeing Shecky Green trying to entertain the checkout girl who didn't get him at all. And I wanted to say, believe me, I get you, you know. And a friend of mine, Tony Prima, her mom is Keely Smith, who lived out here for many years. Great singer.
Keely Smith, so I was friends with Jerry Vale.
And
Keely and Jerry were very close. And Keely's from Virginia, and I grew up in Virginia. And often Keely would not remember my name, but she would come up to me. She's like, you're that boy from Virginia, aren't you? Yes, I am. And Shecky, I had Shecky on Eye in the Desert a few times. Shecky never changed. He was always the acerbic guy, and he was always mad at me because often on TV I wear a pocket square. And he'd go, what the hell are you wearing a pocket square for? This is not a formal occasion. It's just a goddamn TV show. Why are you all so damn dressed up? He was always mad about
it. So he was always Shecky.
Oh, 100% always Shecky.
Very funny.
He was very upset about the pocket square.
So when you're not writing in town, what do you do? What do you do for entertainment here?
You know, I just moved to Palm Desert. So I'm sort of in the middle of moving right now. So that's taking up my summer.
Yeah, that's no fun.
Sorry, I'm really tied up over the next couple of weeks.
Randy's got nothing but free time.
I do have some boxes, Randy.
He's got nothing but free time, and he drives a station wagon. He's your best friend now.
I think that's great. We'll talk.
We'll talk.
I just sort of live my life, and I sort of have planned out the next couple of months August. Back in September, I'll go back into the play and try and have a draft of that done by the end of the year.
Tell us about the play. And tell us about the part you're writing for Randy.
I don't want to say too much about Randy's part because we're negotiating.
I understood.
But
it's going to be an easy negotiation.
Randy has already said yes.
Yes. And I don't want to say too much about the play itself, but I will tell you it's about religion. And it is about how religion can be the most wonderful thing in the world and nurture you and inspire you. It can also just ruin you. And the question is, how do you approach it? And what do you take from it? And what do you put out? That's it. In a nutshell.
Just those little
thing.
That's a big shift, though, because these are, fantasy stories.
It is.
And so now you're dealing with some really existential questions.
One set, seven characters. That's it.
Is that something you've been wanting to write for a while?
Yeah. Yeah. I really have.
Yeah.
Yes, I have. I have. And it just seems, fruition-wise, it's time to do it. So
you were caught by the spirit box, maybe not for the same reason that I was. You're writing a play now about religion.
Yes.
Is there something in there that's bringing this all out?
Boy, that's a good question.
Did you come from a religious family?
I did. My grandfather was a Methodist minister. My dad was, as I said, a lawyer. And I will tell you, I'm going to give you a quote, if I may.
Okay.
I think I have this here. There is, someone had asked me if I had a sort of a life philosophy, or because this deals with the hereafter, if I had a take on that. And I kind of don't, but S.J. Perlman does, and he plays a minor role in this. And he and Dorothy Parker go to a sunrise service. Because they're still up and they've been drinking and they're
and that's what you do.
Kind of being silly.
Who doesn't love Dorothy Parker?
And they're confronted by the minister who is putting this sunrise service on. And he's surprised to see them there because he thinks they're heathens. But he basically says something to the fact of, I'm surprised to see the two of you in church. And SJ says, well, no, it's true when it comes to the hereafter. I don't know where we're going or how we'll get there. But when we get there, we'll be there. And that's something, even if it's nothing.
Even if it's nothing.
I think that's such a great quote.
That's a great quote.
And I thought, God, can I please get that quote in this book? So I shoehorned it in, and there it is.
There it is.
So that's my answer. I don't know. I don't have the answers. But I'll tell you what, if we get there and there's something, great.
Are you still seeking the answers?
Oh, I think every day. I think not just spiritually, but just in terms of life, and I mean, that's what all is this is about, you know? Anything, acting, and anything we do is, if you're thinking it through, you're trying to find the answer and trying to learn. And that's one thing that is key for Edison in this book. He comes back in a reincarnated state, but he is delighted to find that he still has the capacity to learn.
That's pretty cool.
That's
Are the
phenomenal.
Books written in
That's terrific.
In a chronologically where I should be reading them in the order you wrote them?
You don't have to. I've tried to make them stand alone to a certain extent. But, yeah, if you want to read all three, knock yourself out.
I'm going to. I can't wait.
But this one is, yeah, I would say read all three. But this is standalone. You could get into this and have a very satisfying finale.
So how many years did it take you to do the trio?
12.
Wow.
Off and on. Off and on. Yeah. The last one wrote quickly. The first one took a long time. A really long time.
I know a lot of writers have a process. And some people still write longhand. What is your process? Do you sit down at the computer and bang it out? Do you assign yourself times to have to sit down and write? I mean, how do you discipline yourself?
When I'm writing, I mean fresh writing, I just sit down and go. And then I beat the hell out of it for the next four or five days. And I'm very big on rewriting because I really think that's where nuance comes in and pays off.
Yeah, you talked about kind of a two-step approach where the first step is just the throwing up of all the ideas.
Yep.
And then the rewrite is getting down into the nitty-gritty of it all.
Yes. And very much like this play that I'm working on now, I know what the elements are, but it's a question of where do you put them? Because there's an emotional payoff that triggers the next emotional payoff and the next and the next. So it's just a question of placement.
Do you have like boards up on your wall and
stuff? I don't do that.
No.
I don't do that.
No storyboarding.
I'm not into AI and I'm still keeping it all in here. That may change.
How do you feel about that, AI?
I think for basic stuff, for research stuff, I think it's fine. I think for creative writing, I think it's nonsense. I really do. I think that what you're going to get is cookie cutter stuff, much of which you already have with real writers.
Yeah, it's drawn on the source material.
But it's just going to be flat.
So you've done screenwriting, novels, playwriting. What's your favorite? Where's home for you when you sit down to write? What do you want to start to write?
You know, every project is different. So you kind of key into that project. And, you know, sometimes content does dictate form. And oftentimes it does. I just enjoy the process. I really enjoy it. It's like solving an enormous puzzle. And I should mention, I did write a show, another show, called Judy's Scary Little Christmas. And we wrote this about 20 years ago. I wrote it with two guys, Jim Weber, and I wrote the book, Joe Patrick Ward, who's a good friend of Del Shore's and has been the musician for most of his shows.
Yeah.
Joe wrote the music and lyrics, and it gets done like once every 2 years. We did it in LA a couple of times. It won some awards, and, you know, it was just a nice experience. So there you go.
Have you ever considered taking these into like a graphic novel or something, like adult comic books?
You know, it's a possibility.
Yeah.
But I just haven't explored it. I just felt that initially I needed to get it out.
Yeah.
Get it here.
Yeah. You clearly see things.
Yes.
Like you're writing what you see. I feel like you visualize what you write.
Yes, I do.
Or vice versa.
Yeah.
You write what you're visualizing.
Yeah.
But you write very cinematically.
Well, you know, William Goldman, who's a famous screenwriter, used to say, the great thing is you can finish your screenplay and they may just rip the hell out of it. But the thing is, the grace is, you're the first one to see the movie. And I agree with that.
I really like that.
All right. Once again, the books, we start with Thomas Edison and the Purgatory Equation. And then Thomas Edison and the Lazarus Vessel, the third and final. Thomas Edison and the Magi Solution. You can find these wherever books are sold.
I already know what I'm doing today.
Where you can find them is on Amazon.
Amazon.
Yes. And if you want to see the book trailers, just to get a sense of what they're about, go to the website, EdisonTrilogy.com.
All right. EdisonTrilogy.com.
That's it.
All right. David Church, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you guys for having me.
This has been a blast.
We look forward to having you back when the play is finished and you can tell us more about that. And I know Randy's going to see a script or two, but he likes to craft his part. He really, you know.
Yeah.
I want to play Edison.
You know, I would sign him now before the award.
If
he wins the theater league.
Which he
thing,
is going to win because you're announcing it.
I am announcing it. So, okay. I'll be
out of here the next day.
Yeah, the salary's going to go
that?
Up. David Church, our guest. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My thanks to Randy Florence. Another great show. Yeah. You always do. But I really love the fact that he did as much or more research.
Much better research. I should have read his notes.
Of course, John McMullen, our producer. Thank you, sir. Thanks to Skip Page and his little bar team over here, Katie and Chloe and the group. Moe's over there today.
Yeah.
And, of course, our thanks to the McCallum Theater, our presenting sponsor, helping make Big Conversations Little Bar possible. Please subscribe so you never miss an episode. I'm Patrick Evans. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Big Conversations Little Bar, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, the center of the Coachella Valley universe. This program has been presented by the McCallum Theater. Learn about upcoming performances and other community offerings at mccallumtheater.org. or call the box office to purchase tickets by phone at 760-340-2787. This program is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System and is available from Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Captivate.fm, Spotify, and YouTube.
Big conversations, little box.